ask questions like, what would you do if you won the lottery? Or, taking a different tack, what would you do if all jobs paid the same? The idea behind such thought exercises is exactly that of constraint relaxation. To make the intractable tractable. To make progress in an idealized world that can be ported back to the real one. If you can't solve the problem in front of you, solve an easier version of it, and then see if that solution offers you a starting point or a beacon in the full-blown problem. Maybe it does. What relaxation cannot do is offer you a guaranteed shortcut to the perfect answer. But computer science can also quantify the trade-off that relaxation offers between time and solution quality. In many cases, the ratio is dramatic, a no-brainer. For instance, an answer at least half as good as the perfect solution in a quadrillionth of the time. The message is simple but profound. If we're willing to accept solutions that are close enough, then even some of the hairiest problems around can be tamed with the right techniques. Temporarily removing constraints, as in the minimum spanning tree and the what if you won the lottery examples, is the most straightforward form of algorithmic relaxation. But there are also two other, subtler types of relaxation that repeatedly show up in optimization research. They have proven instrumental in solving some of the field's most important intractable problems, with direct real-world implications for everything from city planning and disease control to the cultivation of athletic rivalries. Uncountably many shades of gray, continuous relaxation. The traveling salesman problem, like Megan Bellow's search for the best seating arrangement, is a particular kind of optimization problem known as discrete optimization. That is, there's no smooth continuum among its solutions. The salesman either goes to this town or to that one. You're either at table 5 or at table 6. There are no shades of gray in between. Such discrete optimization problems are all around us. In cities, for example, planners try to place fire trucks so that every house can be reached within a fixed amount of time, say 5 minutes. Mathematically, each fire truck covers whatever houses can be reached within 5 minutes from its location. The challenge is finding the minimal set of locations such that all houses are covered. The whole fire and emergency profession has just adopted this coverage model, and it's great, says University of Wisconsin-Madison's Laura Albert McClay. It's a nice, clear thing we can model. But since a fire truck either exists at a location or it doesn't, calculating that minimal set involves discrete optimization. And as McClay notes, that's where a lot of problems become computationally hard, when you can't do half of this and half of that. The challenge of discrete optimization shows up in social settings too. Imagine you wanted to throw a party for all your friends and acquaintances, but didn't want to pay for all the envelopes and stamps that so many invitations would entail. You could instead decide to mail invitations to a few well-connected friends and tell them to bring everyone we know. What you'd ideally want to find then is the smallest subgroup of your friends that knows all the rest of your social circle, which would let you lick the fewest envelopes and still get everyone to attend. Granted, this might sound like a lot of work just to save a few bucks on stamps, but it's exactly the kind of problem that political campaign managers and corporate marketers want to solve to spread their message most effectively. And it's also the problem that epidemiologists study in thinking about, say, the minimum number of people in a population, and which people, to vaccinate to protect a society from communicable diseases. As we noted, discrete optimization's commitment to whole numbers, a fire department can have one engine in the garage or two or three, but not 2.5 fire trucks or pi of them, is what makes discrete optimization problems so hard to solve. In fact, both the fire truck problem and the party invitation problem are intractable. No general efficient solution for them exists. But as it turns out, there do exist a number of efficient strategies for solving the continuous versions of these problems, where any fraction or decimal is a possible solution. Researchers confronted with a discrete optimization problem might gaze at those strategies enviously, but they can also do more than that. They can try to relax their discrete problem into a continuous one and see what happens. In the case of the invitation problem, relaxing it from discrete to continuous optimization means that a solution may tell us to send someone a quarter of an invitation and someone else two-thirds of one. What does that even mean? It obviously can't be the answer to the original question, but like the minimum spanning tree, it does give us a place to start. With the relaxed solution in hand, we can decide how to translate those fractions back into reality. We could, for example, choose to simply round them as necessary, sending invitations to everyone who got half an invitation or more in the relaxed scenario. We could also interpret these fractions as probabilities. For instance, flipping a coin for every location where the relaxed solution tells us to put half a fire truck, and actually placing a truck there only if it lands heads. In either case, with these fractions turned back to whole numbers, we'll have a solution that makes sense in the context of our original discrete problem. The final step, as with any relaxation, is to ask how good this solution is compared to the actual best solution we might have come up with by exhaustively checking every single possible answer to the original problem. It turns out that for the invitations problem, continuous relaxation with rounding will give us an easily computed solution that's not half bad. It's mathematically guaranteed to get everyone you want to the party while sending out, at most, twice as many invitations as the best solution obtainable by brute force. Similarly, in the fire truck problem, continuous relaxation with probabilities can quickly get us within a comfortable bound of the optimal answer. Continuous relaxation is not a magic bullet. It still doesn't give us an efficient way to get to the truly optimal answers, only to their approximations. But delivering twice as many mailings or inoculations as optimal is still far better than the unoptimized alternatives. Just a speeding ticket, Lagrangian relaxation. Vizzini, inconceivable! Inigo Montoya, you keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. The Princess Bride. One day, as a child, I was complaining to my mother about all the things I had to do. My homework, my chores. Technically, you don't have to do anything, she replied. You don't have to do what your teachers tell you. You don't have to do what I tell you. You don't even have to obey the law. There are consequences to everything, and you get to decide whether you want to face those consequences. My kid mind was blown. It was a powerful message, an awakening of a sense of agency, responsibility, moral judgment. It was something else, too, a powerful computational technique called Lagrangian relaxation. The idea behind Lagrangian relaxation is simple. An optimization problem has two parts, the rules and the scorekeeping. In Lagrangian relaxation, we take some of the problem's constraints and bake them into the scoring system instead. That is, we take the impossible and downgrade it to costly. In a wedding seating optimization, for instance, we might relax the constraint that tables each hold 10 people max, allowing over full tables but with some kind of elbow room penalty. When an optimization problem's constraints say, do it or else, Lagrangian relaxation replies, or else what? Once we can color outside the lines, even just a little bit and even at a steep cost, problems become tractable that weren't tractable before. Lagrangian relaxations are a huge part of the theoretical literature on the traveling salesman problem and other hard problems in computer science. They're also a critical tool for a number of practical applications. For instance, recall Carnegie Mellon's Michael Trick, who, as we mentioned in Chapter 3, is in charge of scheduling for Major League Baseball and a number of NCAA conferences. What we hadn't mentioned is how he does it. The composition of each year's schedule is a giant discrete optimization problem, much too complex for any computer to solve by brute force. So each year, Trick and his colleagues at the Sports Scheduling Group turn to Lagrangian relaxation to get the job done. Every time you turn on the television or take a seat in a stadium, know that the meeting of those teams on that court on that particular night, well, it's not necessarily the optimum matchup, but it's close. And for that, we have not only Michael Trick, but 18th century French mathematician Joseph-Louis Lagrange to thank. In scheduling a sports season, Trick finds that the continuous relaxation we described previously doesn't necessarily make his life any easier. If you end up with fractional games, you just don't get anything useful. It's one thing to end up with fractional allocations of party invitations or fire trucks, where the numbers can always be rounded up if necessary. But in sports, the integer constraints on how many teams play a game, how many games are played in some, and how many times each team plays every other team are just too strong. And so we cannot relax in that direction. We really have got to keep the fundamental discrete part of the model. Nonetheless, something has to be done to reckon with the sheer complexity of the problem. So, we have to work with the leagues to relax some of the constraints they might like to have, Trick explains. The number of such constraints that go into scheduling a sports season is immense, and it includes not only the requirements arising from the league's basic structure, but also all sorts of idiosyncratic requests and qualms. Some leagues are fine with the second half of the season mirroring the first, just with home and away games reversed. Other leagues don't want that structure, but nonetheless demand that no teams meet for a second time until they've already met every other team once. Some leagues insist on making the most famous rivalries happen in the final game of the season. Some teams cannot play home games on certain dates due to conflicting events at their arenas. In the case of NCAA basketball, Trick also has to consider further constraints coming from the television networks that broadcast the games. Television channels define a year in advance what they anticipate A games and B games to be, the games that will attract the biggest audience. Duke versus UNC is a perennial A game, for instance. The channels then expect one A game and one B game each week, but never two A games at the same time, lest it split the viewership. Unsurprisingly, given all these demands, Trick has found that computing a sports schedule often becomes possible only by softening some of these hard constraints. Generally, when people first come to us with a sports schedule, they will claim, "We never do X and we never do Y." Then we look at their schedules and we say, "Well, twice you did X and three times you did Y last year." Then, "Oh yeah, well, okay. Then other than that, we never do it." And then we go back to the year before. We generally realize that there are some things they think they never do that people do do. People in baseball believe that the Yankees and the Mets are never at home at the same time. And it's not true. It's never been true. They are at home perhaps three games, perhaps six games in a year at the same day. But in the broad season, 81 games at home for each of the teams, it's relatively rare. People forget about them. Occasionally it takes a bit of diplomatic finesse, but a Lagrangian relaxation, where some impossibilities are downgraded to penalties, the inconceivable to the undesirable, enables progress to be made. As Trick says, rather than spending eons searching for an unattainable perfect answer, using Lagrangian relaxation allows him to ask questions like, how close can you get? Close enough, it turns out, to make everyone happy, the league, the schools, the networks, and to stoke the flames of March Madness, year after year. Learning to relax. Of the various ways that computational questions present themselves to us, Optimization problems, one part goals, one part rules, are arguably the most common. And discrete optimization problems, where our options are stark either-or choices with no middle ground, are the most typical of those. Here, computer science hands down a disheartening verdict. Many discrete optimization problems are truly hard. The field's brightest minds have come up empty in every attempt to find an easy path to perfect answers, and in fact are increasingly more devoted to proving that such paths don't exist than to searching for them. If nothing else, this should offer us some consolation. If we're up against a problem that seems gnarly, thorny, impassable, well, we might be right. And having a computer won't necessarily help. At least, not unless we can learn to relax. There are many ways to relax a problem, and we've learned of three of the most important. The first, constraint relaxation, simply removes some constraints altogether and makes progress on a looser form of the problem before coming back to reality. The second, continuous relaxation, turns discrete or binary choices into continua. When deciding between iced tea and lemonade, first imagine a 50-50 Arnold Palmer blend, and then round it up or down. The third, Lagrangian relaxation, turns impossibilities into mere penalties, teaching the art of bending the rules, or breaking them and accepting the consequences. A rock band deciding which songs to cram into a limited set, for instance, is up against what computer scientists call the knapsack problem, a puzzle that asks one to decide which of a set of items of different bulk and importance to pack into a confined volume. In its strict formulation, the knapsack problem is famously intractable, but that needn't discourage our relaxed rock stars. As demonstrated in several celebrated examples, sometimes it's better to simply play a bit past the city curfew and incur the related fines than to limit the show to the available slot. In fact, even when you don't commit the infraction, simply imagining it can be illuminating. The conservative British columnist Christopher Booker says that when we embark on a course of action which is unconsciously driven by wishful thinking, all may seem to go well for a time, but that because this make-believe can never be reconciled with reality, it will inevitably lead to what he describes as a multi-stage breakdown. Dream, frustration, nightmare, explosion. Computer science paints a dramatically rosier view. Then again, as an optimization technique, relaxation is all about being consciously driven by wishful thinking. Perhaps that's partly what makes the difference. Relaxations offer us a number of advantages. For one, they offer a bound on the quality of the true solution. If we're trying to pack our calendar, imagining that we can magically teleport across town, we'll instantaneously make it clear that 8 one-hour meetings is the most we could possibly expect to fit into a day. Such a bound might be useful in setting expectations before we face the full problem. Second, relaxations are designed so that they can indeed be reconciled with reality. And this gives us bounds on the solution from the other direction. When continuous relaxation tells us to give out fractional vaccines, we can just immunize everyone assigned to receive half a vaccine or more, and end up with an easily calculated solution that requires at worst twice as many inoculations as in a perfect world. Maybe we can live with that. Unless we're willing to spend eons striving for perfection every time we encounter a hitch, hard problems demand that instead of spinning our tires, we imagine easier versions and tackle those first. When applied correctly, this is not just wishful thinking, not fantasy or idle daydreaming. It's one of our best ways of making progress. 9. Randomness. When to leave it to chance. I must admit that after many years of work in this area, the efficacy of randomness for so many algorithmic problems is absolutely mysterious to me. It is efficient. It works. But why and how is absolutely mysterious. Michael Rabin. Randomness seems like the opposite of reason, a form of giving up on a problem, a last resort. Far from it. The surprising and increasingly important role of randomness in computer science shows us that making use of chance can be a deliberate and effective part of approaching the hardest sets of problems. In fact, there are times when nothing else will do. In contrast to the standard deterministic algorithms we typically imagine computers using, where one step follows from another in exactly the same way every time, a randomized algorithm uses randomly generated numbers to solve a problem. Recent work in computer science has shown that there are cases where randomized algorithms can produce good approximate answers to difficult questions faster than all known deterministic algorithms. And while they do not always guarantee the optimal solutions, randomized algorithms can get surprisingly close to them in a fraction of the time, just by strategically flipping a few coins while their deterministic cousins sweat it out. There is a deep message in the fact that on certain problems, randomized approaches can outperform even the best deterministic ones. Sometimes the best solution to a problem is to turn to chance rather than trying to fully reason out an answer. But merely knowing that randomness can be helpful isn't good enough. You need to know when to rely on chance, in what way, and to what extent. The recent history of computer science provides some answers, though the story begins a couple of centuries earlier. Sampling. In 1777, George Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, published the results of an interesting probabilistic analysis. If we drop a needle onto a lined piece of paper, he asked, how likely is it to cross one of the lines? Buffon's work showed that if the needle is shorter than the gap between the lines, the answer is 2 over pi times the needle's length divided by the length of the gap. For Buffon, deriving this formula was enough. But in 1812, Pierre-Simon Laplace, one of the heroes of Chapter 6, pointed out that this result has another implication. One could estimate the value of pi simply by dropping needles onto paper. Laplace's proposal pointed to a profound general truth. When we want to know something about a complex quantity, we can estimate its value by sampling from it. This is exactly the kind of calculation that his work on Bayes' rule helps us to perform. In fact, following Laplace's suggestion, several people have carried out exactly the experiment he suggested, confirming that it is possible, although not particularly efficient, to estimate the value of pi in this hands-on way. Throwing thousands of needles onto lined paper makes for an interesting pastime, for some, but it took the development of the computer to make sampling into a practical method. Before, when mathematicians and physicists tried using randomness to solve problems, their calculations had to be laboriously worked out by hand, so it was hard to generate enough samples to yield accurate results. Computers, in particular the computer developed in Los Alamos during World War II, made all the difference. Stanislaw Stan Ulam was one of the mathematicians who helped develop the atomic bomb. Having grown up in Poland, he moved to the United States in 1939 and joined the Manhattan Project in 1943. After a brief return to academia, he was back at Los Alamos in 1946, working on the design of thermonuclear weapons. But he was also sick. He had contracted encephalitis and had emergency brain surgery. And as he recovered from his illness, he worried about whether he would regain his mathematical abilities. While convalescing, Ulam played a lot of cards, particularly solitaire, aka Klondike. As any solitaire player knows, some shuffles of the deck produce games that just can't be won. So as Ulam played, he asked himself a natural question. What is the probability that a shuffled deck will yield a winnable game? In a game like solitaire, reasoning your way through the space of possibilities gets almost instantly overwhelming. Flip over the first card and there are 52 possible games to keep track of. Flip over the second and there are 51 possibilities for each first card. That means we're already up into thousands of possible games before we've even begun to play. F. Scott Fitzgerald once wrote that the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. That may be true, but no first-rate intelligence, human or otherwise, can possibly hold the 80 unvigintillion possible shuffle deck orders in mind and have any hope of functioning. After trying some elaborate combinatorial calculations of this sort and giving up, Ulam landed on a different approach, beautiful in its simplicity. Just play the game. I noticed that it may be much more practical to try laying down the cards or experimenting with the process and merely noticing what proportion comes out successfully, rather than to try to compute all the combinatorial possibilities, which are an exponentially increasing number so great that, except in very elementary cases, there is no way to estimate it. This is intellectually surprising, and if not exactly humiliating, it gives one a feeling of modesty about the limits of rational or traditional thinking. In a sufficiently complicated problem, actual sampling is better than an examination of all the chains of possibilities. When he says better, note that he doesn't necessarily mean that sampling will offer you more precise answers than exhaustive analysis. There will always be some error associated with the sampling process, though you can reduce it by ensuring your samples are indeed random and by taking more and more of them. What he means is that sampling is better because it gives you an answer at all, in cases where nothing else will. Ulam's insight that sampling can succeed where analysis fails was also crucial to solving some of the difficult nuclear physics problems that arose at Los Alamos. A nuclear reaction is a branching process where possibilities multiply just as wildly as they do in cards. One particle splits in two, each of which may go on to strike others, causing them to split in turn, and so on. Exactly calculating the chances of some particular outcome of that process, with many, many particles interacting, is hard to the point of impossibility. But simulating it, with each interaction being like turning over a new card, provides an alternative. Ulam developed the idea further with John von Neumann, and worked with Nicholas Metropoulos, another of the physicists from the Manhattan Project, on implementing the method on the Los Alamos computer. Metropoulos named this approach, replacing exhaustive probability calculations with sample simulations, the Monte Carlo method, after the Monte Carlo Casino in Monaco, a place equally dependent on the vagaries of chance. The Los Alamos team was able to use it to solve key problems in nuclear physics. Today, the Monte Carlo method is one of the cornerstones of scientific computing. Many of these problems, like calculating the interactions of subatomic particles or the chances of winning at solitaire, are themselves intrinsically probabilistic, so solving them through a randomized approach like Monte Carlo makes a fair bit of sense. But perhaps the most surprising realization about the power of randomness is that it can be used in situations where chance seemingly plays no role at all. Even if you want the answer to a question that is strictly yes or no, true or false, no probabilities about it, rolling a few dice may still be part of the solution. Randomized algorithms. The first person to demonstrate the surprisingly broad applications of randomness in computer science was Michael Rabin. Born in 1931 in Breslau, Germany, which became Wrocław, Poland at the end of World War II, Rabin was the descendant of a long line of rabbis. His family left Germany for Palestine in 1935, and there he was diverted from the rabbinical path his father had laid down for him by the beauty of mathematics, discovering Alan Turing's work early in his undergraduate career at the Hebrew University, and immigrating to the United States to begin a PhD at Princeton. Rabin would go on to win the Turing Award the computer science equivalent of a Nobel, for extending theoretical computer science to accommodate non-deterministic cases, where a machine isn't forced to pursue a single option, but has multiple paths it might follow. On sabbatical in 1975, Rabin came to MIT, searching for a new research direction to pursue. He found it in one of the oldest problems of them all: how to identify prime numbers. Algorithms for finding prime numbers date back at least as far as ancient Greece, where mathematicians used a straightforward approach known as the sieve of Eratosthenes. The sieve of Eratosthenes works as follows. To find all the primes less than n, begin by writing down all the numbers from 1 to n in sequence. Then cross out all the numbers that are multiples of 2 besides itself, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, and so on. Take the next smallest number that hasn't been crossed out, in this case 3, and cross out all multiples of that number, 6, 9, 12, 15. Keep going like this, and the numbers that remain at the end are the primes. For millennia, the study of prime numbers was believed to be, as G.H. Hardy put it, one of the most obviously useless branches of mathematics. But it lurched into practicality in the 20th century, becoming pivotal in cryptography and online security. As it happens, it is much easier to multiply primes together than to factor them back out. With big enough primes, say, 1,000 digits, the multiplication can be done in a fraction of a second, while the factoring could take literally millions of years. This makes for what is known as a one-way function. In modern encryption, for instance, secret primes, known only to the sender and recipient, get multiplied together to create huge composite numbers that can be transmitted publicly without fear, since factoring the product would take any eavesdropper way too long to be worth attempting. Thus, virtually all secure communication online, be it commerce, banking, or email, begins with a hunt for prime numbers. This cryptographic application suddenly made algorithms for finding and checking primes incredibly important. And while the sieve of Eratosthenes is effective, it is not efficient. If you want to check whether a particular number is prime, known as testing its primality, then following the sieve strategy requires trying to divide it by all the primes up to its square root. Checking whether a 6-digit number is prime would require dividing by all of the 168 primes less than 1,000. Not so bad. But checking a 12-digit number involves dividing by the 78,498 primes less than 1 million. And all that division quickly starts to get out of control. The primes used in modern cryptography are hundreds of digits long. Forget about it. At MIT, Rabin ran into Gary Miller, a recent graduate from the computer science department at Berkeley. In his PhD thesis, Miller had developed an intriguingly promising, much faster algorithm for testing primality. But there was one small problem. It didn't always work. Miller had found a set of equations expressed in terms of two numbers n and x, that are always true if n is prime, regardless of what values you plug in for x. If they come out false even for a single value of x, then there's no way n can be prime. In these cases, x is called a witness against primality. The problem, though, is false positives. Even when n is not prime, the equations will still come out true some of the time. This seemed to leave Miller's approach hanging. Rabin realized that this was a place where a step outside the usually deterministic world of computer science might be valuable. If the number n is actually non-prime, how many possible values of x would give a false positive and declare it a prime number? The answer, Rabin showed, is no more than 1/4. So for a random value of x, if Miller's equations come out true, there's only a 1 in 4 chance that n isn't actually prime. And crucially, each time we sample a new random x and Miller's equations check out, the probability that n only seems prime but isn't really, drops by another multiple of 4. Repeat the procedure 10 times, and the probability of a false positive is 1 in 4 to the 10th power, less than 1 in a million. Still not enough certainty? Check another 5 times, and you're down to 1 in a billion. Vaughn Pratt, another computer scientist at MIT, implemented Rabin's algorithm and started getting results late one winter night while Rabin was at home having friends over for a Hanukkah party. Rabin remembers getting a call around midnight. "Michael, this is Vaughn. I'm getting the output from these experiments. Take a pencil and paper and write this down." And so he had that 2 to the 400th power minus 593 is prime. Denote the product of all primes p smaller than 300 by k. The numbers k times 338 plus 821 and k times 338 plus 823 are twin primes. These constituted the largest twin primes known at the time. My hair stood on end. It was incredible. It was just incredible. The Miller-Rabin primality test, as it's now known, provides a way to quickly identify even gigantic prime numbers with an arbitrary degree of certainty. Here we might ask a philosophical question about what the meaning of is is. We're so used to mathematics being a realm of certainty that it's jarring to think that a number could be probably prime or almost definitely prime. How certain is certain enough? In practice, modern cryptographic systems, the ones that encrypt internet connections and digital transactions, are tuned for a false positive rate of less than 1 in a million billion billion. In other words, that's a decimal that begins with 24 zeros. Less than 1 false prime for the number of grains of sand on Earth. This standard comes after a mere 40 applications of the Miller-Rabin test. It's true that you are never fully certain, but you can get awfully close, awfully quick. Though you may have never heard of the Miller-Rabin test, your laptop, tablet, and phone know it well. Several decades after its discovery, it is still the standard method used to find and check primes in many domains. It's working behind the scenes whenever you use your credit card online, and almost any time secure communications are sent through the air or over wires. For decades after Miller and Rabin's work, it wasn't known whether there would ever be an efficient algorithm that allows testing primality in deterministic fashion, with absolute certainty. In 2002, one such method did get discovered by Manindra Agrawal, Neeraj Kayal, and Nitin Saxena at the Indian Institute of Technology. But randomized algorithms like Miller-Rabin are much faster, and thus are still the ones used in practice today. And for some other problems, randomness still provides the only known route to efficient solutions. One curious example from mathematics is known as polynomial identity testing. If you have two polynomial expressions, such as 2x cubed plus 13x squared plus 22x plus 8, and 2x plus 1 times x plus 2 times x plus 4, working out whether those expressions are in fact the same function by doing all the multiplication then comparing the results can be incredibly time-consuming, especially as the number of variables increases. Here again, randomness offers a way forward. Just generate some random x's and plug them in. If the two expressions are not the same, it would be a big coincidence if they gave the same answer for some randomly generated input. And an even bigger coincidence if they also gave identical answers for a second random input. And a bigger coincidence still if they did it for 3 random inputs in a row. Since there is no known deterministic algorithm for efficiently testing polynomial identity, this randomized method, with multiple observations quickly giving rise to near certainty, is the only practical one we have. In praise of sampling. The polynomial identity test shows that sometimes our effort is better spent checking random values, sampling from the two expressions we want to know about, than trying to untangle their inner workings. To some extent, this seems reasonably intuitive. Given a pair of nondescript gadgets and asked whether they are two different devices or two copies of the same one, most of us would start pushing random buttons rather than crack open the cases to examine the wiring. And we aren't particularly surprised when, say, a television drug lord knifes open a few bundles at random to be reasonably certain about the quality of the entire shipment. There are cases, though, where we don't turn to randomness, and maybe we should. Arguably the most important political philosopher of the 20th century was Harvard's John Rawls, who set for himself the ambitious task of reconciling two seemingly opposite key ideas in his field, liberty and equality. Is a society more just when it's more free or more equal? And do the two really have to be mutually exclusive? Rawls offered a way of approaching this set of questions that he called the veil of ignorance. Imagine, he said, that you were about to be born but didn't know as whom, male or female, rich or poor, urban or rural, sick or healthy. And before learning your status, you had to choose what kind of society you'd live in. What would you want? By evaluating various social arrangements from behind the veil of ignorance, argued Rawls, we'd more readily come to a consensus about what an ideal one would look like. What Rawls' thought experiment does not take into account, however, is the computational cost of making sense of a society from behind such a veil. How could we, in this hypothetical scenario, possibly hope to hold all of the relevant information in our heads? Set aside grand questions of justice and fairness for a moment and try to apply Rawls' approach merely to, say, a proposed change in health insurance regulations. Take the probability of being born, perhaps, as someone who grows up to become a town clerk in the Midwest. Multiply that by the distribution of the different healthcare plans available to government employees across various Midwestern municipalities. Multiply that by actuarial data that offer the probability of, for instance, a fractured tibia. Multiply that by the average medical bill for the average procedure for a fractured tibia at a Midwestern hospital, given the distribution of possible insurance plans. Okay, so would the proposed insurance revision be good or bad for the nation? We can barely hope to evaluate a single injured shin this way, let alone the lives of hundreds of millions. Rawls' philosophical critics have argued at length about how exactly we are supposed to leverage the information obtained from the veil of ignorance. Should we be trying, for instance, to maximize mean happiness, median happiness, total happiness, or something else? Each of these approaches, famously, leaves itself open to pernicious dystopias, such as the civilization of Omelas, imagined by writer Ursula K. Le Guin, in which prosperity and harmony abound, but a single child is forced to live in abject misery. These are worthy critiques, and Rawls deliberately sidesteps them by leaving open the question of what to do with the information we get from behind the veil. Perhaps the bigger question, though, is how to gather that information in the first place. The answer may well come from computer science. MIT's Scott Aronson says he's surprised that computer scientists haven't yet had more influence on philosophy. Part of the reason, he suspects, is just their failure to communicate what they can add to philosophy's conceptual arsenal. He elaborates, one might think that once we know something is computable, whether it takes 10 seconds or 20 seconds to compute is obviously the concern of engineers rather than philosophers. But that conclusion would not be so obvious if the question were one of 10 seconds versus 10 to the 10th to the 10th seconds. And indeed, in complexity theory, the quantitative gaps we care about are usually so vast that one has to consider them qualitative gaps as well. Think, for example, of the difference between reading a 400-page book and reading every possible such book, or between writing down a 1,000-digit number and counting to that number. Computer science gives us a way to articulate the complexity of evaluating all possible social provisions for something like an injured shin. But fortunately, it also provides tools for dealing with that complexity. And the sampling-based Monte Carlo algorithms are some of the most useful approaches in that toolbox. When we need to make sense of, say, national healthcare reform, a vast apparatus too complex to be readily understood, our political leaders typically offer us two things: cherry-picked personal anecdotes and aggregate summary statistics. The anecdotes, of course, are rich and vivid, but they're unrepresentative. Almost any piece of legislation, no matter how enlightened or misguided, will leave someone better off and someone worse off. So carefully selected stories don't offer any perspective on broader patterns. Aggregate statistics, on the other hand, are the reverse: comprehensive but thin. We might learn, for instance, whether average premiums fell nationwide, but not how that change works out on a more granular level. They might go down for most, but Omalas style leaves some specific group, undergraduates or Alaskans or pregnant women, in dire straits. A statistic can only tell us part of the story, obscuring any underlying heterogeneity. And often we don't even know which statistic we need. Since neither sweeping statistics nor politicians' favorite stories can truly guide us through thousands of pages of proposed legislation, a Monte Carlo-informed computer scientist would propose a different approach: sampling. A close examination of random samples can be one of the most effective means of making sense of something too complex to be comprehended directly. When it comes to handling a qualitatively unmanageable problem, something so thorny and complicated that it can't be digested whole, solitaire or atomic fission, primality testing or public policy, sampling offers one of the simplest and also the best ways of cutting through the difficulties. We can see this approach at work with the charity GiveDirectly, which distributes unconditional cash transfers to people living in extreme poverty in Kenya and Uganda. It has attracted attention for rethinking conventional charity practices on a number of levels, not only in its unusual mission, but in the level of transparency and accountability it brings to its own process. And the latest element of the status quo that it's challenging is success stories. If you regularly check our website, blog, or Facebook page, writes program assistant Rebecca Lang, you may have noticed something you don't often see: stories and photos of our recipients. The problem isn't that the glowing stories proffered by other charities aren't true. Rather, the very fact that they were deliberately chosen to showcase successes makes it unclear how much information can be gleaned from them. So GiveDirectly decided to put a twist on this conventional practice as well. Every Wednesday, the GiveDirectly team selects a cash recipient at random, sends out a field officer to interview them, and publishes the field officer's notes verbatim, no matter what. For instance, here's their first such interview with a woman named Mary, who used the money for a tin roof. She was able to make a better house, and that was a tinned house. She was also able to buy a sofa set for her own house. Her life has changed because she used to have a leaking roof soaking up everything in the house whenever it rained, but because of the transfer, she was able to make a better tinned house. We hope that this gives you confidence in all types of information we share with you, Lang writes, and maybe even inspires you to hold other organizations to a higher bar. The three-part trade-off. At once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement, especially in literature, and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean negative capability, that is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. John Keats. There is no such thing as absolute certainty. but there is assurance sufficient for the purposes of human life. John Stuart Mill. Computer science is often a matter of negotiating trade-offs. In our discussion of sorting in Chapter 3, for instance, we noted the trade-off between time spent up front on sorting versus the time spent later on searching. And in the discussion of caching in Chapter 4, we explored the trade-off of taking up extra space, caches for caches for caches, to save time. Time and space are at the root of the most familiar trade-offs in computer science. But recent work on randomized algorithms shows that there's also another variable to consider, certainty. As Harvard's Michael Mitzenmacher puts it, what we're going to do is come up with an answer which saves you in time and space and trades off this third dimension, error probability. Asked for his favorite example of this trade-off into uncertainty, he doesn't hesitate. A colleague just said that there should be a drinking game, that every time this term appears on one of my slides, you have to take a drink. Have you ever heard of bloom filters? To understand the idea behind a bloom filter, Mitzenmacher says, consider a search engine like Google, trying to crawl the entire web and index every possible URL. The web is comprised of well over a trillion distinct URLs, and the average URL weighs in at about 77 characters long. When the search engine looks at some URL, how can it check whether that page has already been processed? Just storing a list of all the URLs that have been visited would take a huge amount of space, and repeatedly searching that list, even if it were fully sorted, could prove a nightmare. In fact, it could well be that the cure is worse than the disease. In other words, checking every time to make sure that we're not re-indexing a page might be more time-consuming than just indexing the occasional page twice. But what if we only needed to be mostly sure this URL was new to us? That's where the bloom filter comes in. Named for its inventor, Burton H. Bloom, a bloom filter works much like the Rabin-Miller primality test. The URL is entered into a set of equations that essentially check for witnesses to its novelty. Rather than proclaim n is not prime, these equations say, I have not seen n before. If you're willing to tolerate an error rate of just 1% or 2%, storing your findings in a probabilistic data structure, like a bloom filter, will save you significant amounts of both time and space. And the usefulness of such filters is not confined to search engines. Bloom filters have shipped with a number of recent web browsers to check URLs against a list of known malicious websites. And they are also an important part of cryptocurrencies, like Bitcoin. Says Mitzenmacher, the idea of the error trade-off space, I think the issue is that people don't associate that with computing. They think computers are supposed to give you the answer. So when you hear in your algorithms class, it's supposed to give you one answer, it might not be the right answer. I like to think that when students hear that, it focuses them. I think people don't realize in their own lives how much they do that and accept that. Hills, valleys, and traps. The river meanders because it can't think. Richard Kenny. Randomness has also proven itself to be a powerful weapon for solving discrete optimization problems, like assembling the calendar for NCAA basketball, or finding the shortest route for a traveling salesman. In the previous chapter, we learned how relaxation can play a big role in cutting such problems down to size, but the tactical use of randomness has emerged as an arguably even more important technique. Imagine you're putting together a globe-trotting 10-city vacation, your own version of the traveling salesman problem. You'll start and finish in San Francisco and visit Seattle, Los Angeles, New York, Buenos Aires, London, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Istanbul, Delhi, and Kyoto. You might not be too worried about the total length of the route, but you probably do want to minimize the monetary cost of the trip. The first thing to note here is that even though 10 cities hardly sounds like a lot, the number of possible itineraries is 10 factorial, more than 3.5 million. In other words, there's no practical way for you to simply check every permutation and pick the lowest price. You have to work smarter than that. For your first attempt at an itinerary, you might look at taking the cheapest flight out of San Francisco. Let's say it's Seattle. Then taking the cheapest flight from there to any of the other remaining cities. Call it Los Angeles. Then the cheapest from there, say New York, and so forth, until you're at your 10th city and you fly from there back to San Francisco. This is an example of a so-called greedy algorithm, which you can also think of as a myopic algorithm, one that short-sightedly takes the best thing available every step of the way. In scheduling theory, as we learned in Chapter 5, a greedy algorithm, for instance, always doing the shortest job available without looking or planning beyond, can sometimes be all that a problem requires. In this case, for the traveling salesman problem, the solution given by the greedy algorithm probably isn't terrible, but it's likely to be far from the best you can do. Once you've assembled a baseline itinerary, you might test some alternatives by making slight perturbations to the city sequence and seeing if that makes an improvement. For instance, if we are going first to Seattle, then to Los Angeles, we can try doing those cities in reverse order, LA first, then Seattle. For any given itinerary, we can make 11 such two-city flip-flops. Let's say we try them all, and then go with the one that gives us the best savings. From here, we've got a new itinerary to work with, and we can start permuting that one, again, looking for the best local improvement. This is an algorithm known as hill climbing. Since the search through a space of solutions, some better and some worse, is commonly thought of in terms of a landscape of hills and valleys, where your goal is to reach the highest peak. Eventually, you will end up with a solution that is better than all of its permutations. No matter which adjacent stops you flip, nothing beats it. It's here that the hill climbing stops. Does this mean you've definitely found the single best possible itinerary, though? Sadly, no. You may have found only a so-called local maximum, not the global maximum of all the possibilities. The hill climbing landscape is a misty one. You can know that you're standing on a mountaintop because the ground falls away in all directions, but there might be a higher mountain just across the next valley, hidden behind clouds. Consider the lobster stuck in the lobster trap. Poor beast, he doesn't realize that exiting the cage means backtracking to the cage's center, that he needs to go deeper into the cage to make it out. A lobster trap is nothing other than a local maximum made of wire, a local maximum that kills. In the case of vacation planning, local maxima are fortunately less fatal, but they have the same character. Even once we've found a solution that can't be improved by any small tweaks, it's possible that we are still missing the global maximum. The true best itinerary may require a radical overhaul of the trip, doing entire continents in a different order, for instance, or proceeding westward instead of eastward. We may need to temporarily worsen our solution if we want to continue searching for improvements. And randomness provides a strategy, actually several strategies, for doing just that. Out of the local maximum. One approach is to augment hill climbing with what's known as jitter. If it looks like you're stuck, mix things up a little. Make a few random small changes, even if they are for the worse. Then go back to hill climbing. See if you end up at a higher peak. Another approach is to completely scramble our solution when we reach a local maximum and start hill climbing anew from this random new starting point. This algorithm is known, appropriately enough, as random restart hill climbing, or more colorfully as shotgun hill climbing. It's a strategy